From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, no ground war for US troops in Iraq. President Obama outlines his anti-ISIS military strategy, stressing the fight in Iraq is a global responsibility.
As your commander-in-chief, I will not commit you and the rest of our armed forces to fighting another ground war in Iraq.
We hear from our Africa correspondent after dozens of worshippers are killed following the collapse of a Nigerian church. And the eve of history, millions prepare to cast their vote on the future of Scotland.
It's the biggest electoral event Scotland's ever seen. The profile internationally, nationally and in Scotland of the voters themselves is huge. And the importance of the decision that's being made could not be bigger for Edinburgh.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the main headlines.
From feature story news in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The final day of campaigning is underway in Scotland before voters go to the polls to vote in a referendum for independence on Thursday. Three new opinion polls suggest the no side is slightly in the lead at 52%, with the pro-independence camp at 48%. This comes following polls from last week, which placed the yes side higher than the pro-union camp for the first time. Scottish First Minister Alex Salmond, who is leading the Yes campaign, says Scots hold the country's future in their hands.
At the end of this campaign, I would say that it's quite conclusively not about political parties or any politician, myself included. This is about the most democratic, energising and empowering campaign that's certainly been witnessed in Scotland, and I would suspect in Western Europe.
U.S. troops will not be fighting another ground war in Iraq, and America will not fight Iraq's own war. That's the message from President Barack Obama. Addressing troops at U.S. Central Command in Tampa, Florida, the president pushed back against Military Chief General Martin Dempsey, who has raised the possibility of boots on the ground in the fight against Islamic State militants. From Washington, Nina Maria Potts reports.
In a direct rejection of the view expressed by his top military chief, General Martin Dempsey, President Barack Obama said American troops are not engaged and will not be engaged in combat in Iraq. In thanking U.S. troops for carrying the burden of a decade of war, the president explicitly stated that he would not commit them to another war and that America expects its allies in the region to fight their own battles.
One of the things we've learned over this last decade is America can make a decisive difference. But I want to be clear, the American forces that have been deployed to Iraq do not and will not have a combat mission.
The World Bank has said that the current outbreak of Ebola in West Africa could drain billions of dollars from economies in the region by the end of next year, if the disease is not brought under control. The bank said that tourism and trade in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea could be seriously affected. Lorna Shattuck has this report.
The World Bank's president, Jim Yong Kim, said in a statement that there are huge potential costs from the current Ebola epidemic if containment efforts aren't ramped up. The organization predicts that in the worst-case scenario, Guinea's economic growth could be reduced by 2.3% next year, while Sierra Leone's would be cut by nearly 9%. But Liberia would feel the worst effects, with a reduction of over 11% predicted. The bank added that inflation and food prices are already affected in the region because of panic buying, shortages and speculation. The announcement comes after President Obama pledged on Tuesday to send 3,000 US military personnel to the region. Lorna Shattuck, Washington.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. 67 South Africans have been confirmed dead after part of a church collapsed in Lagos, Nigeria. Officials are still contesting the cause and the exact number of people who died when part of the synagogue church of the All Nations Pentecostal group collapsed on Friday. Many followers of the church believe its leader, T.B. Joshua, can perform miracles. Gary Alfonso reports.
Lagos emergency service workers and volunteers are still frantically searching the rubble at the site of the collapsed building for any sign of survivors. South African President Jacob Zuma said his office had been informed that 67 South Africans were confirmed dead, but in Nigeria, local emergency services say they cannot verify any numbers. In South Africa, a 24-hour call center is dealing with around-the-clock queries, and relatives of South African victims are being flown to Lagos to identify bodies and repatriate them, but the identities of the deceased have not yet been made public. Gary Alfonso, Lagos.
One of Russia's richest men, Vladimir Yevtushenko, is under house arrest on suspicion of money laundering and stealing shares. His oil and telecom company, Sistema, saw its share price on the Moscow exchange fall by 37%. Jack Perrick reports from Moscow.
The Federal Investigative Committee in Russia says the 65-year-old billionaire, worth around $4.4 billion, was involved in the illegal acquisition of oil assets when his company, Sistema, took over six companies from the Bashtek Group in 2009. A spokesperson for the Russian President Vladimir Putin has denied the arrest of Mr. Yevtushenkov is a political move, but it's immediately been compared to the arrest and 10-year imprisonment of Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the former head of UKOS, who was pardoned only in December. If Vladimir Yevtushenkov is found guilty, he's likely to face a 10-year jail sentence too. Jack Parag, Moscow.
For the rest of the day's stories, you can follow us on Twitter at Feature Story. And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
After a decade of massive ground deployments, it is more effective to use our unique capabilities in support of partners on the ground so they can secure their own country's futures. And that's the only solution that will succeed over the long term. We'll use our air power. We will train and equip our partners. We will advise them and we will assist them. We will lead a broad coalition of countries who have a stake in this fight, because this is not simply America versus ISIL. This is the people of the region fighting against ISIL. It is the world rejecting the brutality of ISIL in favor of a better future for our children and our children's children, all of them.
No ground war for U.S. troops in Iraq, President Obama's comments, in stark contrast with General Martin Dempsey's earlier suggestion that U.S. soldiers could potentially accompany Iraqi forces in a combat role against Islamic State fighters. Speaking at U.S. Central Command at MacDill Air Force Base in Florida, Mr. Obama stressed the importance of a continued U.S. and international response to IS militants in Iraq and Syria.
These terrorists pose a threat to the people of Iraq, the people of Syria, the broader Middle East, including our personnel, our embassies, our consulates, our facilities there. And if left unchecked, they could pose a growing threat to the United States.
So, is the United States now at war with the Islamic State? A question Gideon Rachman of the Financial Times put to the paper's Beirut correspondent, David Gardner, and its foreign editor, Rula Khalaf.
I think everybody's tried to avoid using the word war because this is a much more long-term campaign, I think quite limited in scope, and probably the military side is just one aspect of it. So I don't think we can compare this to the Gulf Wars. I don't think we can compare it to the campaign in Iraq. But I think it is probably going to be a long, sustained, but lower level military campaign, and mostly through the use of air power rather than any troops on the ground, except perhaps eventually special forces.
David, how does it look in the region? I mean, is there a coherent regional willingness to isolate Islamic State?
Well, there's certainly a consensus of panic, if you like, but that doesn't translate into a political or strategic consensus, it seems to me. I mean, part of the problem is, you know, Barack Obama keeps insisting that the strategy he unveiled last week to deal with the Islamic State is a counter-terrorism operation, similar to U.S. actions in Somalia and Yemen. Frankly, I mean, there's a collective dropping of hearts and jaws. If that's the sort of free-for-all between rival militias and warlords, whether mitigated or exacerbated by episodic drone strikes is a matter of debate. But if that's what success looks like, then, you know, failure must be truly awesome to contemplate. And the underlying point is, or points, is one, that the stakes are so much higher, and two, that defeating ISIS will require a really delicately crafted political strategy for any military action to have a prayer. And it's not clear. I mean, there's a lot of rustling in the undergrowth going on, suggesting that that's what they're angling towards, but it's certainly not clear that they're close to it. I mean, you know, you want Milhouse to start with the size of the American bet which is placed on Saudi Arabia. You know, to what extent does Saudi Wahhabi Islam, in its doctrinal sense, in its ideas, differ from what is being promulgated by ISIS and their so-called Islamic State? There's no real counter-narrative there.
As you say, David, the Saudi element is one big unanswered question in this, and ruler, I guess, another that everybody touches on is Syria, because on the one hand, he's fighting ISIS in Iraq. On the other hand, Obama is still adamantly opposed to the Assad regime, which is also fighting ISIS in Syria. Are we any closer to resolving that contradiction?
Well, I think that even before you discuss the political shortcomings of what might be a strategy, and we're not sure yet, there's a very big problem on the military side, which is that in Iraq, the Obama administration has the support of the government in fighting ISIS. Whether we like this government or not, it will be working with the government and with the Iraqi military. In Syria, it has to work against the existing government, and it has to work in a way that any airstrikes do not in any way benefit the Assad regime. And I think that is very tricky. It's not clear to me how they'll be able to square that.
Yeah, I mean, because essentially they're opposed to both sides, both of the two strongest sides in the Syrian civil war. So it's what do they want to happen?
Well, they are also, from a legal point of view, they will be striking at targets in Syria against the will of the government. There, they're intervening in a war. But there's also the question of, you know, unless you have someone to replace ISIS and to actually fill the vacuum, then who's going to fill it other than the regime of Assad?
I mean, David, you've, I know, been a very strong advocate in the past of trying to give more support to the moderate rebels against the Assad regime in Syria. Does this feel like too little, too late? Is that still the right thing to be doing?
Yeah, I think it is, but it's obviously not sufficient at this stage when they have been ground between the two stones of the Assads and the jihadis. They still do have a presence. They still can make a partial impact, but clearly it's not sufficient. And as Ruda said, one can just about see a path towards success in Iraq, a long path, on which, because there seems there to be almost universal agreement, but there is none on Syria, which is the heart of the problem. Ultimately, there are a number of things that need to happen here. I mean, one is you need to turn the Sunnis away from seeing jihadism as a lesser evil, and that is partly a political task. Why? Because of the enormous sense of betrayal by the West and by the Arabs of the Sunni majority in Syria and of dispossession of the Sunni minority in Iraq. Now, quite how you do that, you know, it requires a coming together of the principal actors, in this case, some form of détente between Sunni Saudi Arabia and Shiite Iran. And, you know, underlying this, I mean, if Iran can ditch Maliki, the question then becomes, in Iran, under what circumstances would it dump the Assads, who are essentially wards of the Iranian state, very high maintenance and unreliable ones, but is it possible, therefore, to conceive of a transition without the Assads based on power sharing between residual regime elements and mainstream rebels?
David Gardner, Beirut correspondent of the Financial Times, ending that conversation with the paper's foreign editor, Rula Khalaf, and international affairs commentator, Gideon Rachman. You can find their coverage of the battle against Islamic State in the paper and online at ft.com. This is FSN Reports. Campaigning for the Scottish independence referendum is over, with just hours to go until voting stations open. More than 4 million people are registered to vote on Thursday when they'll decide whether Scotland should leave or stay part of the UK. Our correspondent Dan Whitehead reports from Edinburgh.
Have you got a phone? Late Wednesday afternoon, ballot boxes left government buildings for polling stations. Around 5,500 voting booths are opening to the millions who have signed up to take part in this historic referendum. A logistical challenge for organisers like Chris Hycock, Edinburgh's deputy counting officer.
It's the biggest electoral event Scotland's ever seen in terms of size, the biggest electorate we've ever had. The profile internationally, nationally and in Scotland of the voters themselves is huge, and the importance of the decision that's being made could not be bigger for Edinburgh.
Throughout Thursday, votes will be cast in 32 council areas, with the results expected to start coming in the early hours of Friday. The Yes campaign has gained considerable support in these final weeks of campaigning, but there are some who are concerned about the implications. Peter Rinaldi says his business will cope with whatever happens. His fishmongers has been smoking fresh Scottish salmon since 1923.
I would like to see the best for Scotland, whether it's a yes or a no vote. The public will decide, the customer, you know, they are the people who's going to decide what way we're going to go.
With pledges being made on both sides of the argument, change is inevitable. Whatever the result is in the referendum, one thing is for sure, the people inside the Scottish Parliament will get more power. If Scots vote yes to independence, a timetable kicks in to start the mammoth task of just how it'll work. SNP leader and First Minister Alex Salmond believes it'll take 18 months, others much longer. Nick Beecroft is the chairman of Saxo Capital Markets.
Let's face it, there may be a period of mayhem. There would be a period of mayhem, much longer than the period between the vote and March 2016, which the SNP envisages as the date by which all negotiations, if you like, with the Rump UK would be concluded. It's going to take 2 or 3 years, probably. But get through that. It's a new state. People have talked about a Singapore analogy, a similar size of country. And fine, they could all settle down and in the end work out in that sense.
After years of preparations, the answer to whether Scotland will leave the United Kingdom after more than 300 years of union will lie in these ballot boxes. Dan Whitehead, Edinburgh.
And as the final days of campaigning in Scotland close, the EU has remained quiet about the country's future within the EU should it become independent. And as the final days of campaigning in Scotland close, the European Union has remained quiet about the country's future within the EU should it become independent. Officials in Brussels say they've avoided putting out statements ahead of the referendum to limit influencing the vote. The EU has said in the past that an independent Scotland would become its own country and therefore would have to apply for full membership. FSN's Brussels correspondent Sandra Gatman sat down with the director of European Policy Centre, Fabian Zulig.
Firstly, there will be a gap between a yes vote and actual independence. And during that gap, there would be negotiations. Certainly negotiations with Brussels, but more importantly, negotiations with London about how this divorce is going to actually work out. And as part of those negotiations, there will be the question of EU membership. So at this stage, I think it is impossible to say what will come out. I would expect that certainly Scotland will be, in the longer term, a member of the European Union. I find it hard to believe that a country which fulfills the conditions and which desires to be part of the EU would be kept out indefinitely. But the big question is about what process, what timing, and what conditions. I would actually expect it will be quicker than most people think, because it will be in the interest of the UK to have Scotland in rather than out.
In the various scenarios being played out of an independent Scotland becoming a member of the EU eventually, there's talk of a fast-track process under Article 18, I believe, of the treaties, where the country has adopted most European Union laws anyways, and therefore there could be an acceleration of membership. Do you see that as likely, or do you foresee some member states perhaps posing opposition?
I think the key thing here is it's not really the legal process which matters. It's the political process. Clearly, whatever legal process is chosen, Scotland will have to have the agreement of all 28 member states and the European Parliament. So this unanimity is the key feature. Everyone has to agree. My guess would be that what we will get is a political deal, and that political deal will be between London and the other member states, not between Edinburgh and the other member states, because it is in the interest of London to have an independent Scotland inside. It would be an economic and political nightmare to establish a border between Scotland and England.
How worried, in your view, are the politicians here in Brussels? They've kept quite tight-lipped about the whole thing, you know, obviously not wanting to influence the campaigns either way, but do you sense from the people that you've spoken to that there is huge concern and a huge push for Scotland to remain with the UK?
I think it depends very much on the national background of people. Certainly some countries are more concerned than others. Countries like Spain, clearly, where there's a strong independence movement, traditionally in the Basque country, now in Catalonia as well. I think certainly a number of other countries also have issues around secessionist movements. But I think we shouldn't forget that what we're talking about here is a very different process for Scotland. We are talking about a democratic process, a constitutional process, and we're talking about a national movement which is nothing like the extremist, sometimes violent national movements we've seen in other countries. In fact, the nationalists' key argument at the moment is that they would turn Scotland into a more social democratic place, much more in line with some of the Scandinavian countries. So we are really not talking about the same kind of thing, and we need to be very careful when we draw comparisons. I think what we will see is that even the countries which feel uncomfortable about secessionist movement will recognize that there's a big difference between a constitutional process and one where a region decides by itself to secede.
Do you think that despite the outcome, whichever way it goes, the European Union is now thinking much more seriously about breakaway states and what it would mean for the project?
I think one of the key concerns I have is that the lack of contingency planning, both in the UK and at EU level, has been astonishing when there is a realistic possibility of this happening. I would also point out that if it's a very close vote, we will not see the end of this debate. This will continue, and certainly if there's a move in the UK to exit the European Union, the independence question will be back on the agenda. So it is a topic which the EU will have to deal with. A number of regions will look at the Scottish example as well and demand more autonomy from the central state. Certainly, whatever the outcome of the vote, Scotland will have far more powers than it had before the vote. So we should be dealing with this at the EU level. But if I take history as a guide, we probably will have a lack of planning for this eventuality.
Do you think, my last question to you, do you think in some way, though, it perhaps was a smart option for the European Union to stay out of it? Because obviously, there is a huge political incentive for the European Union to push for further integration, deeper integration. And if it did campaign, or if it did side with the campaign for Scotland to remain with the UK, that perhaps the EU would be seen as taking a very political standpoint on it.
Yeah. I mean, I think even if it might have been in the interest of some member states to have the EU come in on the no side, I think the principle that this is not really an EU issue should have been maintained. And I think that's clearly, in the end, what it comes down to. It is a decision within the member state. It is a decision of a national constitution, a national democracy, which has to also agree on exactly what the modalities are, whether it's allowed to secede, what process you would have to follow. All of this has nothing to do with the EU.
FSN's Brussels correspondent Sandra Gatman with Director of the European Policy Centre, Fabian Zulig. This is FSN Reports. As many as 70 South Africans have been killed after a church building collapsed in Lagos, Nigeria. The church, belonging to the popular TV evangelist T.B. Joshua, collapsed last week. However, information from the Nigerian authorities has been slow to emerge. South African President Jacob Zuma described the incident as the deadliest involving South Africans abroad in our recent history. Our Africa correspondent, Gary Alfonso, has the details.
The fact that the picture is not that clear has perhaps been partly described to the issues on the ground, where rescue workers were first of all fighting officials from the church and also other rescue workers in Lagos in trying to get to those injured and possibly even trying to get bodies out of the rubble on that absolutely chaotic scene where the building collapsed. And that's partly perhaps partly to blame for the reason why the exact numbers that we've not been able to establish either from emergency services or even from the official quarters what the exact death toll is. But the fact that there's between 60 to 70 South Africans dead in that collapsed building is not being contested by anyone at this stage.
So, Gary, there are two theories that have sort of risen to the surface over this incident. One involves a small plane, a small aircraft. The other is pointing the blame at the structure of the building itself.
Well, commentators on the ground saying the theories as to exactly what happened and that small plane flying overhead, or whether it was the structure to blame, will be carrying on for the next few weeks and perhaps even months and years, because the fact that a small plane did fly over the building several times is not being contested. That's even being confirmed by security footage from a camera across the road where this church is located. But whether or not that plane had anything to do with the collapse has not been confirmed and will obviously be investigated, and that statement coming from church officials. But the fact, one of the facts that is not being contested either, is the fact that the collapse occurred when three extra stories, or as three extra stories, are being added to the existing structure of the two guest houses of the church, because the regular influx of visitors from abroad for church services, which can last up to a week, has created demand for accommodation, and the church's own guest houses has been unable to meet the often spillovers of people visiting the church and would go into local hotels, and the church was trying to accommodate the growing numbers of people coming there, and perhaps in this case, because the structure was just fairly new and still being constructed, could be one of the areas that officials will be looking at very closely into the coming weeks and months.
And Gary, can you tell us a bit about who T.B. Joshua is and explain this popularity he commands, not just in Nigeria, but the wider continent?
There's no disputing the popularity of this T.B. Joshua, who many people believe the leader of the Pentecostal church, who attracts global following of Christians from around the world. They believe that T.B. Joshua can perform miracles, including curing the ills and raising the dead from the grave even. Very famous celebrities and South African sports stars, for instance, have come to Lagos over the past few years, and some even saying that they've been cured of terminal conditions, and that obviously attracting not from all over Africa, but also as far afield as China and Russia, people have been coming to Lagos for services run by the person they call the Prophet T.B. Joshua.
Our Africa correspondent, Gary Alfonso. And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to contact us, you can email us, reports@featurestory.com, and you can follow us on Twitter. We're there, @featurestory. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside Rebecca Foster with The Bulletin. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.